Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Climate change and some of the anticipated consequences have people actually questioning whether we should continue this idea of always growing and progressing and inventing new things, because isn't it progress that has us in this predicament to begin with? Andrew McAfee says, no, in fact, just the opposite. He is a scientist at MIT, best-selling author, and his latest book is called More from Less, the surprising story of how we learn to prosper using fewer resources and what happens next. So you're arguing that the best course of action to deal with climate change is to keep doing what we're doing?
Yeah, exactly. We know the playbook now for simultaneously improving our prosperity, the human condition, and the state of nature, and lessening our footprint on the planet. That's not a mystery anymore. And the point of the book is to highlight that that trade-off is in the rearview mirror and talk about that the fact that we need to not yank the steering wheel in a different direction and do radical things, but actually just step on the accelerator.
Well, so what are we missing here? Because I keep hearing that emissions are only going up. And once the people of China and India start pursuing the same kind of middle class lifestyle that we have, then forget it.
Yeah. And to be clear, emissions, carbon emissions are going up in countries like China and India. But the fascinating part is they have leveled off and they are now decreasing in the rich world, in America and in many European countries. Now, we should be decreasing those emissions even more quickly than we are, and we need to do things like a carbon tax or do cap and trade. But the point I'm making in the book is that we have now learned how to grow our economies while generating less of this kind of pollution.
So the Green New Deal is not just pie in the sky?
Well, it's not because we're following the Green New Deal. It's because we are becoming much more efficient in our economy. Total energy use in America has been flat for about 10 years. Total carbon emissions are declining year after year. Now, I need to say this again. They are not declining quickly enough, and we need to be doing the smart things for pollution, which are to make it expensive so that pollution decreases even faster. If we lead the way on that in America, in the rich world, the rest of the world will follow that. They'll follow the toolkit, and they will start to decarbonize much earlier in their history than we did. So the fighting global warming is difficult. I'm not pretending that it's easy, but it's also not mysterious. We know the playbook for dealing with it. We have vastly reduced air pollution, water pollution in the rich world without crippling the economy, without turning our back on growth and prosperity.
And it sounds like you're also saying that the market system itself, with the right incentives, can take care of this without oppressive government regulations.
Well, with the right incentives, and sometimes those incentives do have to come from government. So, for example, the air in American cities is so much cleaner than it was a generation or two ago because we put in place a cap and trade system for sulfur dioxide and other kinds of atmospheric pollutants. Now, the market left to its own, I don't think would have solved that atmospheric pollution problem. But when you make pollution costly, man, the market will react to that. I always like to say that businesses react to increased costs like gazelle react when they smell a lion. They will just run away from it incredibly quickly. If we do that with carbon, we will be amazed at the benefits from it.
Okay, now being that you're at MIT, you're always on the cutting edge of technology. Does this depend on some radical new breakthrough, or can we accomplish this using things that we are familiar with like solar energy, wind power, et cetera?
I think we have an extraordinarily useful, clean, safe, green, scalable energy source out there, but it scares a lot of people because it's called nuclear. And if you want to look at two of the countries in the world that have the lowest electricity prices, the lowest greenhouse gas emissions, they are Sweden and France, which power a lot of their societies, a lot of their industry via nuclear. So one of the points I make in the book is that, you know, our intuition sometimes leads us astray. My intuition is that nuclear is scary, and I grew up watching Godzilla movies, and I was a kid when Three Mile Island happened. My intuition is wrong. When you look at the evidence, I think you pretty quickly become a pretty strong nuclear advocate. Now, I'm not saying let's not pursue renewables, let's not do that research. Absolutely we should, but I want to let all these different energy sources fight it out on kind of on a level playing field. If we do that, I think our future is going to be pretty nuclear powered, but it would require us to get past the ick factor, and it's absolutely there with nuclear, even though it shouldn't be.
Now, I grew up, let's see, within 10 miles of the Indian Point nuclear power plant on the Hudson River in New York, and back in the day, we took classroom tours of it as the next best thing, you know, too cheap to meter. And you're saying that that it can make a comeback?
It absolutely can, and I'm saying it should as well, particularly because we have continued to do research on nuclear designs, and the kind that we have in place now are outdated. If you put in place modern nuclear facilities, the way I think of them is they're kind of like a battery for a city. You can kind of put them in place, hopefully the latest ones, and just let them run for a couple decades and power large amounts of households and industry. Again, we need to get past our visceral reaction, the ick factor. I just don't think it's based in reality.
Well, explain how you can do that, because I'm seeing there are a few, only a handful, but a few environmentalists who are saying the very same thing, that the only zero carbon technology out there is nuclear power, and it's been redesigned, and it's not like Fukushima anymore, and yet it's a non-starter, I think, with most committed environmentalists. Why?
Yeah, that's right. But for example, I'm hugely respectful of Stuart Brand, who's one of the grandfathers of the environmental movement. And when he looked at the evidence, he changed his mind, and he's now a huge pro-nuclear advocate. I believe the problems we have with nuclear energy are problems of perception. They're political problems. They're actually not primarily technological problems. And I think that's a damn shame, because we have to reduce our greenhouse gases around the world. We have a great tool to do that. We can't let the ick factor dominate that discussion.
Okay, so what role should this play in the coming campaign? Are there any candidates you think have gotten it right?
I don't see anyone's platform that I wholeheartedly agree with. I hear people trying to decommission nuclear. I hear people talking about a Green New Deal that includes a lot of stuff that's not directly related to climate and to pollution and to species protection. We have environmental issues. I'm not trying to be a Pollyanna here, but we do know the playbook for dealing with those issues. Make the pollution expensive, invest in technologies that are proven to work. And if we're worried about species loss, for example, great. Put those animals outside the market. You cannot hunt whales anymore in most countries around the world. And whale populations are making a really, really strong comeback. So again, we have hard work ahead of us, but we don't have any deep mysteries. We do know the playbook, and it's the playbook that's been put together by prosperous societies with a public that demands action and a government that responds to them.
Andrew McAfee is the author of More From Less, The Surprising Story of How We Learn to Prosper Using Fewer Resources and What Happens Next. Andrew, thanks very much.
Dave, thanks a lot.
This looks to me like it's shaping up as a case study in how people become homeless. A lot of people who live in a government-owned low-income project could end up basically losing their home. We have a two-year lead time to figure out what to do. Hannah Scott, what's happening in Linwood?
So this is the Whispering Pines complex. We talked about this on Friday. 240 government-owned unit complex owned by the Snohomish County Housing Authority. It's going to be demolished. There's been a council member, George Hurst, who's been trying to find ways to help these folks. They were going to upzone. All of that failed. And more than a year ago, he started floating the idea of taking advantage of this law that is on the books. It's a state law that allows a city in this specific circumstance, where we're talking about low-income housing that's going to be demolished and displace these folks, where they can pass an ordinance that would require relocation assistance of up to $2,000 per unit that would be split between the landlord, in this case, the housing authority, and the city. This allows the city, though, to reach into a pot of money that's heavily spending restricted. It's the real estate excise tax money. So they can use that. They've got excess of that. And that's what he's trying to do here. He floated this idea over a year ago to get the council to approve that. They didn't really bite at that time. So now he came back yesterday with a plan to just form a task force, a voluntary task force, to start talking about actually passing that so that they could provide this relocation assistance to these people. Many of the Whispering Pines residents showed up to this meeting last night to really urge them to say, yes, let's form this task force. We need help.
Where are you going? There's nowhere to go.
I need help with my packing and with moving.
Will any of you help us?
What kind of learning environment would it be for the children to do homework, reading, writing, and math from their cars or their homeless encampment?
There's no place for us to go.
Yeah. Okay, so this is a case where you have, how many people are living in that apartment complex?
There's
now
240 units. It's 800 to 900 are expected total.
900 people are about to lose their homes.
Yes.
You have a two-year lead time. We know that if somebody loses their home and becomes homeless, to help them cost something like $100,000 a person per year. Isn't that the figure we showed?
Yeah.
Why don't you just give them money?
They are...
because that would be cheaper than what's about to happen, it seems.
I'll tell you what killed this last night, and it really did. This was a more than three-hour meeting. A lot of other business came up, but there was a lot of people. That one person came out and spoke in public comment against the idea of them, again, not even passing the actual ordinance to take and use this money.
Has
make
that
this
apartment
happen.
Complex just been a crime problem or something? Why people? I mean, because they were going to build a new building on that same parcel, right?
They were going to, but they needed an up zone because that was.
Why can't they get that?
Because the council voted it down, and that was in the end because.
Because there are no apartments in Lynnwood?
Because the single family homeowners came out and spoke heavily against that. They did not want it.
Because they've already got an apartment building there.
They wanted to upzone to six stories on part of this property.
Well, how tall is the building now?
Three stories now.
So it'd be six stories instead of three, and that's going to change the community.
That was a big problem for a lot of the single family homeowners. In the end, though, this to create this task force died at the end of this meeting last night. They put it off for another week that they'll maybe take it up again later. But again, it's come up before. Process killed this. The people on the council on a 4-3 vote said, look, you went about bringing this to our attention the wrong way. It should have gone meeting, blah, blah, blah.
So now when we have 800 homeless people, can there be a requirement that their tents have to be located in Lynnwood? Or are they going to move down to Seattle and make Seattle taxpayers pay for it?
Well, the one woman I spoke to, we talked to last week, Darla Ray, she's got a homeless encampment right around the back of her house, and she said that's where she'll end up if this doesn't happen.
And the neighbors okay with that?
they weren't at this meeting, actually. And in fact, there were homeowners and former council members who came out and spoke really strongly in favor of the city council doing this. The city council was heavily criticized last night for not having any affordable housing plan, for not doing this. One gentleman who's a homeowner came out and said, you should be embarrassed for not making this a priority. This is a small amount of money. Again, there was nothing binding in this. It was just to create a task force to talk about using this money for relocation assistance. And that couldn't even get past the council. It's just really more process that I've seen even in Seattle City Council.
Mm. I mean, there are already trailer parks in Lynnwood, right? There are places like that. Do they want more of those?
No, absolutely
they don't
not.
Want those either.
But I'll tell you what, they have to do something. And this is Councilmember Hurst's position. These light rail is coming to Lynnwood. There is an enormous amount of development coming to Lynnwood. It's not affordable development.
Right.
There are a lot of people that are going to be in the same situation. They need to get this law on the books so they can provide these people relocation assistance. The other issue, too, half of these folks are Section 8, and they are, because they are moving out because of HUD changes and funding, going to have $300 or so dollars less on their housing vouchers, which means they need even more time to try to find what they're going to do when they have to move.
Well, there you go. If you want to know where the homeless people are coming from, Lynnwood in 2 years.
Yeah.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Seattle merchants are at their wits' end to do something about shoplifting, and so I thought we'd talk to a couple of people who've worked on this problem in the real world to see what works and what doesn't. Representative Roger Goodman and Judge David Larson, who's with the Federal Way Civil Court. And Roger, as a state representative, I want to ask you, first of all, what's happening on the state level here?
I guess there's two categories of shoplifting. One is what we call organized retail theft, which is, you know, people with criminal intent, stealing lots of stuff, organized about it. And then there's sort of your run-of-the-mill shoplifting, picking up an item here and there. And needless to say, businesses lose billions of dollars nationwide on that. But I think the real problem is focusing on this sort of organized theft.
Now, is it out of hand? Has it gotten worse in recent years? Because that's certainly the perception.
Well, we hear that from the retailers, and we've tried to amend the law, and I hope we can get it done this year, to take account of intent. In other words, if you put something in your pocket intending to leave the store, our current law doesn't allow law enforcement to intervene until you leave the store, until you're outside.
So if a security guard sees you pocket some makeup or lipstick or, you know, a cell phone card, they can't do anything until you actually try to leave the store.
Right. So right now, they have to wait till they get outside, and then the car's waiting and running and can cause, you know, danger in the parking lot.
So
the loss prevention officers in the stores want to be able to intervene in the store. And so we need to change the theft law to account for this concealment, sort of, you know, the showing of intent to steal.
Judge Larson, in federal way, is there something different about the shoplifting we see today as opposed to what it may have been like 20 or 30 years ago?
The demographic is much different. From what I hear, there's more violence associated with shoplifting. People are more desperate because they're a lot of folks that are addicted are concerned about their withdrawal. So they are doing everything they can to get that next dollar they can get so they can buy more drugs so they don't get to that point. And so the desperation becomes greater, and so you're seeing a little bit more.
You can't reason with someone like that. Right. They're just so desperate for that hit, they'll do anything.
Right. And some reticence by some of the retailers is now they don't want their employees in danger. My son's friend is a loss prevention. He got his head ran over by a car.
Really?
Yeah. And so it bottom line is that there's both the safety of the workers as well as the safety of the public that you're concerned about, too.
Has the justice system gone soft?
I think when we take the approach of compassion over accountability, then we go soft. If we are compassion in balance with accountability, then we're doing the right thing. My experience is when you have to reach the person, you have to get them mm-hmm. to decide for themselves to change. Yeah. And I think right now we're reaping the punishment of not taking these more seriously when somebody first commits a crime. So the first time somebody commits a crime and there's any evidence of mental illness or addiction contributing to this, we should be addressing it then.
And that's where the state would have to step up, right, Roger? Because we have sort of dropped the ball on mental illness, haven't we?
We have, and we are finally turning around. I mean, we've invested hundreds of millions of dollars. We need more, brick and mortar. We need beds. We need more professional workforce. So we're starting to make the investment. But, yeah, this has been a generation of neglect of our behavioral health system. I think ultimately it's a question of resources again. We have to have those places to go. I can't tell you the number of times law enforcement say to me, if there was another place I could take them, I would. Sort of in my jurisdiction, because I chair the Public Safety Committee, what does the criminal justice system need to, as the judge was saying, acknowledge that the underlying cause is behavioral health and intervene that way? So as not needlessly to punish, but not just to say, well, here's a fine and don't come back again, because they come back 72 times.
Right, exactly. So, Judge, in federal way, when you find somebody who needs that kind of mental health treatment, is there a place you can send them now?
That's where the rub is. The problem with the system we have now is I can order somebody to go get treatment, but then they go out and say they're addicted, say they got a co-occurring disorder, it's addiction and mental illness. They can't get in for an evaluation for 2 or 3 weeks. They're all motivated, but in the meantime, they relapse. And then they might get another warrant. They don't show up for court. And it's this cycle that's almost predictable that you see once somebody gets that first crime, that it just snowballs from there because we aren't able to get in early with the resources.
What can be done now then? I understand with the mental health part, that's going to take a lot more money. But I keep coming back to the people who really are just flaunting the fact that they can do this and get away with it. Now, is there a way that you can at least send a message to them that it's no more Mr. Nice Guy?
I think what you have to have is you have to have this system that is based upon if you're one of the can'ts, if you're somebody that just can't do it and you need help, we need to help. But if you're a won't, if you just flat out don't want to cooperate, don't want to participate, then the punitive system needs to kick in.
So when you get a bona fide won't in your courtroom, right?
Right.
What happens to that person?
Well, the bona fide won'ts go to jail in federal
way. They do.
Yeah.
Now, does that work? Does that deter people?
I think to some people it does, to others it doesn't. I mean, I've had just a kind comment made to one woman that it made all the difference in the world. I just said, you're going to get through this, and that made all the difference in the world. And you got other people. I got a guy that's I haven't seen in a while, but he has over 200 crimes. 200 crimes. I put him away for 400 days one time, and he was back within 2 weeks.
And he's a won't. This isn't just illness.
Yeah. That's the thing. We have to make these distinctions. You say shoplifter, and what comes into your mind? You know, someone who's intending to steal something. Well, yeah, maybe it's one of those won'ts. They're flouting the law, and they intend to steal. But then another huge category, probably larger category, because this is what we hear from the retailers, are people who are in crisis.
Yeah,
and they don't want to go into withdrawal, or they're not, thinking right. And so that's not the same as sort of criminal intent.
Right. I'll give you one example. Somebody goes to inpatient. Nobody thinks of communicating with the courts, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes they do, but most of the time they don't. And so the person doesn't show up because they're in inpatient treatment, getting treatment. So we issue a warrant. They get out and they move on with their life. They're getting stable and the warrant catches up with them. Now they're back in jail. They lose their housing. Their insurance is suspended. So just coordination.
Yeah, that's dumb.
And communication and the system itself sometimes will contribute to the failure of these individuals. And so how do we shore those things up? How do we make it so that we on our end and the system itself aren't contributing in some way to it? That's why getting somebody the first offense, you can spend less resources on them. If they never come back, we're good to go. Wouldn't it be great if we had a regional approach to being able to have a handoff by courts to services, a warm handoff?
Well, you got to talk to your state legislature about that.
And we are moving in that direction. I mean, I convened a group in Olympia, and I'm going to convene the same group again next month. We are definitely moving in the right direction. And I mean, think about it. 15 years ago, we were locking people up who had addiction. It was the drug war was raging, right? So we really are phasing out of that and looking at it as a health problem. So we have to build up the infrastructure now and then have the courts coordinate with that.
Judge David Larson, Federal Way Civil Court, and Representative Roger Goodman, State Legislature. Thank you both very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Time for your daily dose of kindness. A neighborhood in New York is banding together to help a homeless man. They say he has become the unofficial mayor of West 22nd Street. He's just that delightful. Janelle Johnston is his name. He's been sleeping on the same stoop for about a year now. Neighbors say he goes out of his way to put a smile on everyone's face.
How y'all ladies doing today? God bless y'all. Y'all have a good day.
And he is such a bright spot in their day, they decided to return the favor. They posted more than 100 flyers around their community marketing Jonelle's skills and decades of experience in the food industry. Another neighbor bought him a phone so potential employers could find him. Another bought him a membership to a community center where he could shower and shave.
It could be any of us at any time. He doesn't ask for anything. He just gives you a greeting, and there's no way that you can't greet him back and be grateful.
Jonelle says the support has been incredible.
They think I'm the happiest man in the world, but I may be the saddest man in the world away from my children and grandchildren. But as long as I can see these people every day, I'm okay until I get better.
And this kind work has paid off. Jonelle started a job as a dishwasher this past Friday night.
Hmm. Where is this?
New York.
New York. So they have community centers where you can just take a shower?
Yeah, like a club, yeah. A sports club, something like that, yeah.
It's time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. We haven't talked about the Huskies or the Cougars. So the Huskies did great, right?
They did great for a half. They had me very, very worried at halftime. In fact, kind of disgusted. They were down 17-13 to the Arizona Wildcats. And it wasn't. And then in the second half, I don't know whether their offensive coordinator stopped calling plays and let the head coach take over, or perhaps the quarterback yelled at everybody at halftime and got him motivated, but then they came out and romped in the second half. It was devastating.
Hmm. And what about the Cougs? What do you say about them?
Cougs a little tougher. Cougs have lost three in a row in the Pac-12. They played significantly better this week against Arizona State, but still ended up losing down the stretch to a Sun Devils team that's been pretty good at pulling games out in clutch situations this season and is a tougher team in the Pac-12. But the Cougs have lost three in a row. They've had a change at defensive coordinator. It's a little bit of a tougher slog here for them.
They also had some changes behind the scenes. In the Seattle Times, they have a report about Mike Leach banning some social media from players. What's his motivation there?
The idea is, or his belief is, that guys are too plugged into what people are saying about them instead of how they're playing. And he's not unique among college coaches who will believe that players seeking out or responding to feedback, either positive or negative, on social media can have a negative impact on the way they play. Coaches forever, maybe since the dawn of football coaching, have been seeking to insulate their teams and be the only voice that their teams listen to. So this is just a more modern step in that direction.
Has social media been nasty to the Cougs?
Sure. Go on there and look at what people say about the Cougs.
Why would people say nasty things about the Cougs, Danny?
It's the internet, Dave. Are you unfamiliar with this place? It's a den of savagery and iniquity. It's awful.
Dave rises above. He doesn't seem to be bothered by any of it.
You see what happens on social media. I mean, honestly, how would you advise someone, especially if it was a college kid, to deal with social media? Where, essentially, hey, if you're on social media, eventually people are going to say things that are patently offensive to you. And in fact, they might be saying those things not because they even believe them, but they just want to make you mad. Like, right. Trolling is an actual activity.
Well, are these people who can throw a football? Are these people who can throw a block? No, I mean, not they're just, you know, some schlub
Look
somewhere.
Look at me, Dave. My entire career is testament to the fact that you don't have to be able to do something to talk about it.
Well, that's what I mean.
Well, what do you think about the people who do sling insults at college students? Do we forget that these athletes, because they are so great and they're doing, you know, amazing things that we can't do, we forget that a lot of them are still kids.
I generally agree with you, but this weekend, perhaps I was complaining about Jacob Eason, the Washington quarterback's tendency to spin around to try and evade the pass rush. Is that crossing the line?
Well, you're
I said
not personally.
He was when he tried his spin move, he was as slow as the Apple IIe turtle when you programmed him to go in a circle in Logo. Or was it Logic? Do you
I don't remember know. That? I feel like you're talking about Logo. How he's playing and not necessarily him as a person. I mean, sometimes those insults can be, you know, this person is a waste of space, can't throw a ball to save it. You know what I mean? That gets a little too personal.
I completely agree.
It is pretty nasty, but I mean, he probably knows exactly how good your football is, so.
That's true.
Why should he care
Consider
what you say?
The source. Following that, I tweeted out a picture of me running.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. That's right.
Absurdly, to
That's
show
right.
him. And by pointing out Jacob Eason's speed, I'm significantly slower. Like, I'm that turtle if it absolutely broke.
So Jacob can tweet out your little combine video.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I don't know if this is actually going to work, though. Have you ever tried to abstain from Twitter?
Yeah.
It's
I've actually been doing it. You know, it's not. You can set your device to limit it. And I think you can also, by logging how much time you've done it, I've actually done this over the past 4 weeks. Of I want to spend less time and I want to control what time I spend on social media. So you just log it. Once you log how much time you're actually spent looking at your phone, it becomes jarring and you stop doing it.
The other big issue was the Packers-Lions game, which apparently was decided on a another bad penalty call, hands to the face. Remind us what the hands to the face penalty is.
You cannot, if you're a defensive or an offensive player, you cannot take your hand, put it under the face mask of the opponent, and attempt to leverage it and turn him into a Pez dispenser. You're not allowed to try and make your opponent have a flip-top head. And the officials thought Trey Flowers was doing that to a Packers blocker. In fact, they thought he was doing it twice. And further replay showed that his hand wasn't actually under the face mask. It was simply holding on to his collar. Which is kind of funny because apparently you can turn him into a Pez dispenser if you have a hold of the collar of his jersey, just so long as you're not actually using the face mask as a bottle opener type lever.
I see. But you can't challenge those calls then, right?
No, you can't.
All right.
But if the Packers were going to win, watching a team's fan base wail in agony is pretty entertaining.
A Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thanks, Danny.
You bet. Stay off Twitter, Dave. There are meanies out there.
Okay. And on Tuesday mornings, we go live to the nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold at the Washington Post, otherwise known as President Trump's Javert. Let's go. Let's go to your most recent piece where you talk about the president's claim that he is immune from criminal investigation. Of any kind, pretty much. So explain that argument to us and where that comes from.
Yeah, I don't think this has gotten enough attention. This is a filing Trump has made in federal court trying to fend off an investigation by the Manhattan DA. And effectively, Trump says, well, I don't believe as president, I'm too important to be bothered with being indicted or being imprisoned. And because you can't indict me, that means no one can investigate me. Why would you investigate me unless you were going to indict me? So therefore, and he actually says it this plainly, the president is immune from any criminal investigation of any kind by anyone, state or federal, while he is in office. The only people who can investigate him, Trump says, is Congress.
And this has to, so he's arguing this in the context of his state tax investigation in New York.
This is a case where the Manhattan DA is looking into the hush money payments made to two women who said they had affairs with Trump, Stormy Daniels and somebody else, before 2016, and who got paid and whether they basically the payments were made through Michael Cohen, whether they were sort of accounted for in a way that broke the law or defrauded anybody.
Right. Okay. But in that same argument, he says only impeachment is something that he's subject to, right?
But that's what is really interesting. So Trump is obviously facing arguments from both Congress and facing investigations from both Congress and the local DAs. And he, in the cases where the local, it's the local DA that's his problem, he says, he has one argument, which is, you know, I cannot be investigated by anybody. Only Congress can investigate me. And cases where it's Congress pursuing him, he says, no, Congress can't investigate me in these cases. They lack a legitimate legislative purpose to seek my documents. Only, a, you know, that's law enforcement. Only prosecutors can do that.
Okay, but he has to acknowledge that, that Congress has the power to impeach because it's there in the Constitution, right?
Yes, he says Congress has the power to impeach,
okay.
But he is saying that any investigation Congress launches is not legitimate as long as, you know, even though they have the power to impeach him, they can't investigate him.
Say, as he continues doing these things like, you know, ordering troops out of Syria and the debacle that follows and more comes out about this phone call, is there a possibility he might be trying to hurry up impeachment so, you know, it can be done with, the Senate will not convict him, and then it's past him?
Is this possible, this sort of Brer Rabbit strategy where he wants it to get as bad as possible because he thinks that that's a way out? I don't think I give him that much credit for planning ahead. I think the Syria move, I don't think in his mind he was like, oh, wow, this will be a complete debacle. I think he just didn't understand what he was saying yes to. I think he may want a quick impeachment, as you said, so it'll go to the Senate. He would be not convicted by the Senate, and then he can move on to the 2020 election. But I don't know how much it is in his power to accelerate that. The House already wants to accelerate it. So I don't think Trump can change that very much.
And the Turkey thing, you really think he didn't know what he was saying yes to?
I don't think he knew what he was saying yes to. I think he, you know, what he said has been, well, you know, these people have been fighting each other for thousands of years, even though that's not really correct in this case. You know, let them fight. I'm tired of this. You know, he just gave in to what Erdogan wanted, and I think did not, and this frankly would not be a big surprise, did not think beyond that one step. You know, he didn't think about what happens next. I mean, you can tell that by his reaction, which is he gives Turkey the green light, announces from the White House he's given Turkey the green light.
Right.
Turkey takes the green light. 2 days later, he's like, oh, this is terrible. We have to sanction Turkey for doing the thing I said they could do.
But there was no one to say, you'll regret this, don't do it?
Our reporting has been that there were people who said that very thing. And I think, you know, this has been something that Erdogan's wanted for months. And various people had told Trump, don't do it, this will happen. And he did it anyway. You know, he keeps his own counsel on these things.
Yeah. But he's probably making a calculation that for most people, certainly most of his supporters, they don't care about Syria, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can make that argument about a lot of things. You know, I have to hope that the president thinks about more than just, will this cost him re-election? You know, you have to hope that he thinks about, like, is it the right thing to do? Will it put American troops in harm's way? You know, to think beyond just, like, will this cause my base to abandon me? There's a lot you could do if you're Trump and not lose the, you know, 35% of people who are his base.
Yeah. There is another debate tonight with the Democrats, and I didn't count the number. Do you know how many are on stage tonight?
11. I'm so glad I don't have to cover that. There should not be an 11-person debate.
Yikes. And Tom, this is the first time we're going to see Tom Steyer, right?
Yes. We've lost John Delaney and replaced him with Tom Steyer, who's, as you know, as your listeners probably know, a very rich Democratic donor who's now become a Democratic candidate.
Yeah. I mean, he's running those ads where we're saying impeach Trump or whatever it was. It's looking like Elizabeth Warren is the front runner at this point. Which is, how do the Democrats feel about that? Because there are people who look at her and the first thing they think of is she's, even though she says she's capitalist, with this wealth tax thing, she doesn't sound like one.
Yeah, that's the Warren rise is interesting to me because in some ways it reminds me a little bit of Trump in 2015 in that she, you know, there's all these people in the party and donors who say, I don't like her, I'll never support her, she can never win. You know, if she becomes the nominee, I'll never support her. But meanwhile, you know, she keeps getting attention, she keeps getting big crowds. She's a good politician in a field that does not have very many good politicians, honestly. She's managed to get some attention for herself and her ideas. She's managed to bring people in. You know, I think, you know, she and Biden are still pretty close, and Biden hasn't run a terrible campaign. But, you know, it's just like Trump in that the person who keeps winning, you know, getting more people, gaining in support, is also the person that everyone worries won't win. You know, it's an interesting dichotomy. You're already seeing Biden people saying, kind of in off-the-record leaks, oh, well, we think we're going to lose Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and then we'll win in South Carolina. So, you know, they're already conceding some of the early states to Warren, which is a bad sign this far out.
Let's talk about Hunter Biden. He is, I read his memo yesterday that his work with foreign businesses in Ukraine and China was not improper.
but that he failed to see the political implications on his father's career, incredibly. He was on Good Morning America. They asked him about the accusations he was paid $1.5 billion by a Chinese business venture. Here's what he said.
This is literally has no basis in fact in any way.
Have you received any money from a business dealing?
No.
At all? Not 1 cent?
Not 1 cent.
Right. So he's denying all this and saying, and I believe accurately, that he was never prosecuted. Ukraine found nothing wrong. Apparently he did not earn anything from China. Does this settle the Hunter Biden affair?
I doubt it. If Hunter Biden is an extremely, he's not your sort of typical candidate kid. There was this great New Yorker profile of him a few weeks ago. He's a very profligate drug user. He's had this really chaotic life. He's not somebody who has any sort of real experience in politics or government that would qualify him for these positions. So, you know, if I were the Biden campaign, I would want him to quit everything, quit giving interviews, and just leave. He's not somebody who's ever going to be an asset to his father's campaign. I don't think anybody's proven that he influenced his father's decision-making. Nobody's shown us, okay, when Biden was vice president, he did X to help Hunter Biden. But Hunter Biden clearly seems to have exercised terrible judgment in using his family name to get these business connections. The best thing for Biden would be if he just sort of laid low and didn't show his face again.
Democrats are screaming at the radio saying, you're going to criticize Hunter Biden for trading on his dad's influence. What are Ivanka and Jared and Eric and Don Jr. doing? Same thing.
It's a little bit different, and you know that I am not someone who's a knee-jerk defender of the Trump organization. But in this case, what Hunter Biden did was sort of go out and offer his name. Basically, you couldn't really make a credible argument that he was offering anything beyond his name and the possibility, real or not, of influence over his father. Eric and Don, who run the Trump organization, they have had business dealings with other governments. They have gone overseas and asked for regulatory permissions from foreign governments, but they've mostly been continuing to do the things that they did before. They haven't sort of joined the boards of Ukrainian gas companies or anything like that. They're continuing to, you know, they want to build subdivisions in Scotland and Ireland. They want to expand their golf courses. They're doing what they did before. The bad decisions, the decision to mix politics and government, comes from their father. He's the one who has chosen to mix politics and government, and they're kind of just foot soldiers in that. They're not doing it on their own.
David Ferenthold joins us every Tuesday from the Washington Post. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Let's go! Choke points. Yesterday, we got our first taste of what life's going to be like for how many years now? Next three?
Three and a half.
3.5 years. So let's start with 520.
Okay, yeah. We had a couple of changes over the weekend on some of our bigger commuter routes. And the first one that I'm going to talk about, because it has had the biggest impact, is on westbound 520. A lot of people driving to work yesterday, it was the first commute where we had gone from three lanes down to two on that new westbound bridge that connects the floating bridge over to Montlake. Now, just in case everybody forgot, we have the floating bridge portion. We have a bridge that goes from the floating bridge to Montlake. Then we have another set of bridges that goes from Montlake to I-5. And in this construction project, what they did is they built the new westbound bridge from the floating bridge to Montlake. That's what we've been driving on the last year and a half, 2 years, whatever. Three beautiful lanes getting you into Montlake. However, over the weekend, as we anticipate the start of building the new bridge eastbound from Montlake to the floating bridge, they got rid of one of those westbound lanes because later this year, all eastbound traffic is going to be driving on that new westbound bridge as they tear down that other section going eastbound. So what that means is three lanes down to two, we've lost a third of our capacity. Yesterday, we saw significant backups.
We did, in fact, see a little bit bigger backup than normal. I think that's going to be the new norm now in this area. It's about a mile and a half. A construction area, essentially. So those two lanes westbound will be tight, and they will be that way probably until 2023.
And we saw it again today. And in fact, we are still experiencing it right now from 405 all the way over to the middle of the lake with delays of about 10 to 15 minutes overall. And so we start seeing our commute start a little, or the congestion start a little earlier in the morning, and it extends longer. Yesterday, it went till about 9:45. Today, we'll probably see the same thing. So that's your new life. And Steve Peer with the Washington Department of Transportation said this needs to be done.
It'll take some getting used to. And also, it's a new speed limit. It's 40 miles per hour. So we think the 75,000 vehicles that go through here on a regular basis, they're going to see a change.
Now, I got a rather interesting email overnight, and I responded first thing this morning. The driver's like, what sense does it make to give us three lanes and then take one away? Like, yes. Well, construction, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. I mean, right now, in order to keep the bridge open in both directions, what they are going to have to do later this year is have two lanes westbound, two lanes eastbound, all on that westbound span. That's just the reality. You got the fact that you got it for a year and a half or 2 years going to get with an extra lane there. Just count that as a blessing, because right now it's going away, and that's just the reality.
But for 3.5 years.
Yeah, that, I mean, well, think about it. We did the exact same thing when we built that westbound span. Everybody was on that small eastbound one, two lanes in each direction there. But I know, we got used to having our Taj Mahal, and now we're back to a Motel 6. Not that Motel 6 is bad. Looking at the
Taj Mahal is a tomb. Anyway, go
ahead. Yeah, I know. My metaphors are all over the place. The second change is Highway 99 at the north end of the Seattle Tunnel. The first exit out of the tunnel at Republican routinely backs up because there isn't a lot of space there. The light at Republican and Dexter is super slow sometimes. And so what drivers have been doing on that on-ramp or off-ramp is they've been squeezing two lanes of traffic through the tolling equipment all the way up around the right-hand corner, because eventually that ramp becomes two lanes, a left-turn lane, a right-turn, or a straight. And so what they've figured out is during the tolling testing that they've been doing is that when cars create a second lane there and they drive on the shoulder, the tolling equipment can't figure out what's going on because it was designed to take one lane underneath the tolling equipment. And so they've been getting misreadings, and they're worried they're going to overcharge people, undercharge people. The tolling equipment isn't going to operate properly. So they put little flexible pylons there on the road. I drove through it this morning. There are not a lot of them, but what it does is it channels you into one lane there so you can't confuse the tolling equipment. Then it opens right back up to two lanes. What it's going to do, and what we have seen over the first 2 days of this, is that that northbound drive gets a little busier, because where people were cheating, or not necessarily cheating, but squeezing into a second lane there, allowed just a hair, a little bit more capacity to get through. Right now, we're expect to see some continued more backups in the northbound direction as you approach that interchange there at Republican at the far north end of the tunnel. By the way, tolling begins November 9th, in case you haven't remembered. That's coming up in less than 3 weeks. So,
Have the transportation experts on 520 given any estimate of how many people who are not carpooling now would have to carpool to significantly reduce that backup?
That's a good question, because if you think about it, we have an HOV lane with the buses already coming across, and what we did is we lost that bus lane technically, so they're now having to merge in. So I'm not sure if those buses are still going to have to merge in, but I can certainly ask Steve and the DOT
just
guys
it would be realistic to actually start a campaign, because if this is going up for 3.5 years, I just can't imagine sitting in that every single morning.
Yeah, and people are going to have to learn, are we going to have to go early, go late, instead of paying the toll, maybe go, and what the upshot of this, we might also start seeing some more traffic on over the top of the lake on 522, which has taken the primary diversion. If you think about it, we're still 17% down of daily traffic trips because of the tolling on 520, and a lot of those have gone over the top of the lake. I would expect that to take even more.
That's not a fun drive either.
No. Kenmore, Bothell, Lake Forest Park, no thank you.
Man. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.